Well, first of all, thank you very much. It's clearly a great honor. I'm not, you know, it's. I'm really delighted to be here and to be able to present this work. It's both an honor to actually be invited and a huge opportunity for me to present the research agenda that has taken quite a lot of energy over the last 10 years, and hopefully it will amount to something. But I personally think it's quite interesting. I hope to convince you about that. It's about early childhood development. It's about designing interventions, how these interventions work, whether they offer the opportunity to break the intergenerational cycle of poverty. So, if you like, the overall theme is about poverty alleviation and intergenerational transmission. But before I do anything beyond that, I need to acknowledge that this research agenda involves a number of people who are central to it. It's not, of course. So in all the work I'm going to present today, there are three people who appear in everything, which is Orazio Attanasio, Sally Grantham MacGregor, who is a pioneer in this field, and Marta Rubio Codina. I also draw on joint work with Sarah Catan and Emily Nix, who is happily here as well. And then there are a number of other people involved in the Colombian projects and the Indian projects, some of whom you might know, like Jerry Berman. Okay, having done that, I'm not quite sure exactly why this is not working the way it should, but that's life, I guess. Nothing. Okay, so first of all, I want to show you this fascinating graph. It relates to a paper we published in 2014 in the JHR. What this shows you, this is data from Bogota, Colombia. It's purely cross-sectional data. We tested children between the ages of 6 months and 42 months. And here I'm just showing you how the cognitive development distribution differs by age and wealth. You've obviously guessed that the dark line, the top line, is the cognitive development of children in the upper part of the wealth distribution. And when I say upper part, let me be absolutely clear. This really corresponds to about the median family in Bogota. So we're not talking about some kind of wealthy Manhattan family. We're talking about somebody with really modest means. And yet, you can see the cognitive development is rapidly the gap between them and the lower decile of the children in Bogota widens. You can see that we have several ways of measuring development. One is cognition, the other is language. Language is extremely important. Receptive language is understanding what words means. Expressive language is being able to tell them. There's an important wealth gap. Right, and that, you know, in some sense, what we're trying to do with this research agenda and these policies that we're talking about is address this gap with actual interventions. So, I mean, perhaps this is the wrong place to even have to spend 2 minutes on this, but I will. Human capital is key for escaping poverty and attaining high standards of living. It underlies better wages, improved health, reduced crime, and better outcomes for children. But we do know that in deprived communities around the world, children develop deficits from very early on. And this is basically what I've been showing you here, right? The kids at the bottom are kind of sliding down the relative distribution. And this creates an intergenerational cycle of poverty with deficits of human capital at its heart. So that's what we're trying to address here. Now, the evidence for all this, whether it's economics evidence, whether it's neurological evidence, it points to the early years. But the question is, what do we really know? And how can we design effective and sustainable policies? The broader question relates to the nature of the interventions. Should we be thinking of directly targeted interventions where we go into the households and we do stuff, as I'm going to be describing later, Or should we just thinking of money, like conditional or unconditional transfers, or perhaps a combination of both? I won't answer this question today, but it should be at the back of our mind. Clearly, the way we are taking our agenda forward implies that we believe that that it's better to have direct and prescriptive type interventions, because there are important issues about beliefs and understanding of child development in very poor communities. The background to all this, of course, is three very important interventions. I will just mention the first two. They've been analyzed by Heckman and a number of co-authors. That's the Perry Preschool Experiment and the Abecedarian Program in the U.S. In some sense, the closest thing to what we're doing is the Abecedarian Program. But notice it only involves 111 kids. So we have to keep that in mind, because we're going to be talking about scalable interventions. The main thing that underlies our work and inspires our research agenda is the Jamaica study by Sally Grantham MacGregor and a number of colleagues and co-authors of her in Jamaica, Kingston. Let me tell you about this intervention, which is fascinating. This intervention treats kids between the ages of 6 months and 2.5 years. It's a randomized experiment among approximately 120 kids with three treatments and one control. One treatment is what we call infant stimulation. By the end of this lecture, if you don't know exactly what we mean by stimulation, you will know. It's basically doing what you do with your kids, for those of you who have them. Nutrition is what is basically supplementation with a kind of it's powdered milk effectively there. And the third intervention is both. To cut a very long story short, the only while nutrition and stimulation seem to have both had an effect early on, the only one that had long-term effects was infant stimulation. Now, the Jamaica experiment is actually quite special, because it targeted not only kids from a poor environment, but malnourished kids from a poor environment. We have to keep that in mind, because our population in our experiments that I'm going to talk about are your, quote, average poor person, not the poorest of the poor, not the most deprived. However, this is the amazing and fascinating thing that kind of keeps us going. The red line is the treatment group. The blue line is the control group. The vertical axis are the Z-scores in cognition, normalized at zero. The light blue line is just the evolution of cognition of another group that's not been intervened on, kind of the average poor. By the end of the intervention, which is this point here, the treatment group had an improvement in cognition in this experiment by Sally Grantham MacGregor, that's nothing to do with me, of 80%. Then you have 80% of a standard deviation in cognition. I mean, when economists see 0.01 of something, they're very, very excited, if they stand there, of course. These are big effects, right? These are life-changing. Now, this then faded, half of it was lost relative to the control group, but then it persisted. And this is from The Lancet in 2012. It's from The Lancet. It persisted till 18 years old. And then Sally teamed up with Jim Heckman and Paul Gertler and a number of other colleagues, and they looked at labor market outcomes, and the effects are there as well. Okay, so this is the basis of our work. Now, this experiment and other similar and successful experiments are small-scale efficacy trials that are tightly supervised. In some sense, they are a proof of concept. They say that if you go with a high-quality intervention in a very poor community, you can achieve life-changing effects that persist for a lifetime. They go on into the labor market, and they change outcomes in a substantive way. But they are not scalable. Why they're not scalable? Because, you know, basically in Jamaica, you've got 60 kids are receiving stimulation. The researchers know all of them. The trials are highly supervised. They make sure that exactly what has to be done is done. You cannot do that in a massive policy environment. So to better understand how these ideas can be the form of basis of policy, we need to implement scalable versions. And that's our research agenda. So this involves addressing the sustainability of the program, understanding changes in parental behavior as a result of these interventions. So for example, do parents crowd in or crowd out resources as a result of these interventions? Do they persist beyond the, us being in the field? Do they continue doing what they're supposed to do? Do these ideas propagate in the community in some sense? Do the communities buy into the intervention in such a way that it's going to just happen afterwards, like it happens in among the wealthier groups? These are big questions. So, first of all, I'm going to show you a little table here that I wrote up with the interventions that we carried out and we're carrying out now. First of all, we started with Colombia in 96 towns. So you see already we're talking about implementing an intervention along a large number of towns, about 1,400 kids. The population are conditional cash transfer beneficiaries. Then in Colombia, we just finished another experiment, which I will briefly talk about in the results, based around play groups in special government daycare centers. Again, there, the scalability idea is that we're going to use existing government infrastructure to graft in our intervention and see if it works. Then we have two, or let's call them three, interventions in India. One is a home visiting intervention like the Jamaica / Colombia intervention, and that is that ended, and I'm going to show you results on that. Then there's another one which compares home visits to play groups to nothing in India, and that just finished in December, but we haven't analyzed the data yet. We're collecting the data and going to analyze it soon. And finally, we're doing something that at least I get very excited about. You know, perhaps I'm odd, but I do get excited about it, because at the end of this intervention, we're going to re-randomize these kids here. This is happening literally now. And we're going to place them in high-quality daycare centers, up all the way to school. So we'll have an intervention that starts, let's call it, at zero. For some kids, it stops at three. For other kids, it continues till five or six. For others, it starts at three and continues till six, and other kids get nothing. Everything, by the way, is evaluated by randomized controlled trial. Everything is cluster randomized, so we don't have to worry about spillovers. And indeed, that's how you want to do it for a scalable intervention, right? You want to go into a community, and you want to actually try and implement stuff to see if it's going to work. So the basic design is Sally's Jamaican experiment. However, there are a number of differences. First of all, on the intervention, the emphasis on designing the program using local resources. So we go into X village in Odisha, and we literally locate through the NGO Pradham, who is our key partner, community workers from within the village, and they are going to deliver the program. We implement on very large geographical areas. So in Colombia, it's all over most of the mountainous part of Colombia. In Odisha, it's in three large districts, and so on. Then we mimic the delivery as of scale. So we construct a delivery structure that would be exactly how we would expect the program to be implemented in practice. And whenever possible, we use existing government structures to improve scalability. But of course, this is going to You know, this is going to create a number of issues, right? You know, is it going to work as well as the small efficacy trials? Well, I can tell you, no, it's not going to work as well. But it's actually not that bad, as you will see. So now a bit about what we do. We use what's called the Reach Up and Learn curriculum. And it's supposed to promote, it's designed to promote child development in an integrated manner. Cognitive, language, socio-emotional, or what often we call in economics non-cognitive, and motor skills. The key point is that it encourages mothers to teach her children based on events surrounding daily routine activities. Now you might say, hey Guy, what about the fathers? That's a question we often get. We are not there to go and change the culture of these communities and the gender roles. Right? We accept the gender roles as they are, and the fact is that basically it is mothers who deal with their kids, right? And sometimes it's not the mother, it's the grandmother. So formally we call them the principal caregiver. Now, we encourage the mother to teach her children based on events surrounding daily routine activities, and we involve other children or members of the family where possible. So that helps you propagate the intervention and reinforce it. So we have a bunch of materials. They are called, they are picture books. They are pictures to stimulate conversation, puzzles, stacking blocks, toys, and so on. So just to give you an idea, for example, these are the easier puzzles here. This is a bit of a harder puzzle. This is a harder one. These are pictures with which we kind of try and convince, teach the mother to make up stories for her child and build up conversations. The other thing you might notice is that, you know, these pictures and puzzles and so on relate to people who, they're dressed like the people in the villages. They're culturally adapted, in other words. This is from Colombia. You know, for example, the mother might say, well, look at this child. He's running in front of the bus. He's going to get run over. Whatever. It doesn't matter. You can build a story, right? You know, or dad is always late for the bus or whatever. Okay. So, this is actually going to be quite important from an economic concept point of view. We also teach them how to construct toys through the home business. We don't do that, right? Through our structures. How to construct toys from waste material. Now, this is kind of important if you think of modeling child development and parental investments. These cost nothing, right? So if you go back and think in terms of an economic model, the kind of investments we're talking about are not necessarily investments that are extremely expensive, like going to FAO Schwartz or Toys R Us to get the latest electronic toy. It's about creating a stimulating environment. And that actually, to me, poses some questions as to how we should be thinking of modeling parental investments on kids. And that's going to come up towards the end of this lecture, because, you know, for those of you who know me, you probably have seen that I do a bit of structural work as well. So that's going to appear later. But this does pose some questions, right? You know, if I buy a Calvin Klein jean for my child, and somebody else buys a normal jean, you know, mine costs $500, the other guy buys it for $10. Is the other guy investing more on their child or not? I don't think so. So that poses quite important and difficult economic modeling questions. And this is an example of what mothers actually do as a result of our intervention. These are toys that a mother made as a result of what we said. So how do we design the intervention? The way we do it is a kind of pyramid structure. So think of the child development specialist on the top there, together with a bunch of economists thinking of p-values and t-statistics. And then below that, you have what we call the mentors. Now the mentors are a small number of people who are they would tend to be college graduates in social work or psychology. Then we train the mentors, Right? We take the mentors away and we train them. And then we have the home visitors. The home visitors are literally from within the communities. Right? The mentors train the home visitors. And then they are in touch with them. They do the rounds. So let's say each mentor will have, let's say, something like 10 or 20 communities in charge. They will visit one each day, right? They will, so every couple of weeks, the home visitor is going to be in touch with a mentor who's going to solve problems, right? It's going to see whether things are running properly and so on. Now, we use local women. We think it's very important, not only because they are cheap, right? Not only because it will be impossible to get the hundreds of college graduates you would need to go and run the intervention, but also because it's a way of connecting in the communities and breaking a cultural barrier. You're going to community, you're going to tell people to do things completely different than what they've been doing, right? They never talk to the children, right? It's a huge problem, right? They don't talk to children, they don't interact with children. Suddenly you're going to tell them, don't do that, talk to your child, interact. So the local person there is our the bridge between us and the community and allows buy-in to the community. Secondly, it might be a way of eventually propagating these practices so they become a permanent part of the culture. So we hire every the home business full time and so on. So the home visitor goes to the household once a week for about an hour. Now that's very important to note, because we don't really believe that it is this 1 hour that does the job. It is the shift in the parental behavior, in the investment behavior of the parents, that's supposed to be changing here. Now, the home visitor, practically what happens, she goes in, gets the mother and the child and any other child that wants to participate. They go over what the mother did during the week. And then she introduces new activities and new materials, right? A song, a puzzle, a story, an activity in the home. They will go over it, and then they will ask encourage the mother to do that every day, to make it part of the routine, which is basically the intervention. Let me just show you some quick data about these home visitors. You will see that they are, quotes, slightly more educated, slightly higher ability than the local mothers. You can see it in the two highlighted blue regions. But they are not that different, right? So the home visitor will have, on average, a year more of education. She will be a little bit, you know, higher ability in terms of, let's say, the Peabody picture vocabulary test. The difference is marginally significant. So we're not introducing some super highly qualified people in there, right? We are literally drawing from local resources. This is how a home visit happens. The lady in the purple sari is the home visitor. And you can see from the posture there how the intervention is supposed to work. The mother is sitting with the child and is carrying out the activity under the advice of the home visitor. That's the idea. It's not the home visitor doing a bunch of exercises with the child and then going away. It's actually working with the mother to introduce these activities. An alternative mode of intervention that we have are playgroups. Now, we think that playgroups might be very important, not only because they might be cheaper, but because they improve networking of mothers within the village. So we bring young mothers, particularly mothers who have had just their first child. In India in particular, that's not their village. They've moved from the parental village to the husband's village. So by putting people in play groups, you're creating networks and you might be enabling the transmission of the intervention. I'll show you some results on that. Okay, so RCT, negligible attrition, these are the two key things that you need to know. Always cluster randomized trial. So let's look a bit at the characteristics of the population. This is Colombia. We don't have that much time, so I'm highlighting some important numbers. So in Colombia, the kids are not in such a dire position as they are in India, as you will see on the next slide. But still, you've got about 16% stunting, which is a signal of malnutrition. I was eating fine when I was a kid, so there's a distribution there, right? The 46% anemia, right? Although, as many of you know, I don't eat fish, and my parents would be very upset about that, but I did eat well. So anemia about 46%, that's a lot, right? So basically what you have is kids that are not badly, we're not hugely malnourished, but they are badly nourished in some sense. The other characteristic is the mothers have about a 37% incidence of depression. And you might think that, you know, that's of course a result of poverty, and you might think that's a conduit for, you know, it's a mechanism, A, for the deficits that are building up, and B, for the possible intervention to work. It turns out, just to preempt, that in Colombia we did not affect depression, but in India we substantially reduced depressive symptoms of the mothers. You can see in India, I'm sorry, the numbers are not exactly the same, but things are much worse. So the stunting is much worse. It's about 35%, and the Z score for height for age. Is minus 1.14. That's very low, right? So a lot of kids, much, much smaller than they should be. That's a signal of bad nutrition. Okay. So let me just say one techie thing before we go on. Everything, we've been running a lot of experiments. Everything we do, we correct the p-values for the multiple hypotheses that we are testing. This is extremely important, because you can go along with tons of data mining and so on, and you can get many false positives. So we adjust our p-values using the Romano-Wolf step-down procedure to control for what's called the family-wise error rate, which effectively means that we control the probability of any one false positive out of all the hypotheses that we test in a particular group. Okay. So I wanted to put that in because A, I think it's important, and B, in case you're wondering. So here are the first results. I'm putting next to each other Odisha and Colombia. In Odisha, we're getting 36% of a standard deviation improvement in cognition after 18 months of intervention. We're getting 26% of a standard deviation in receptive language, and we're getting 21% in expressive language. These are quite strong effects. The overall, if you do a kind of factor analysis of this, we're getting 31% of a standard deviation in overall achievement. Nothing on motor skills. In Colombia, which was our first intervention, I'm not sure if it's us who are learning or what, but we still get strong effects, 26% of a standard deviation, very significant, 22% in language, nothing in anything else. And I would also like to tell you that in Colombia, we also offered micronutrient supplementation to some arms, and micronutrient supplementation had no effect on child development whatsoever, despite the high level of anemia that we observed. These effects are heterogeneous, and I'm looking at this only in India. So here I've got two panels which we're treating separately. One is the gender differences, and the other is the mother's education difference. We find, at least in terms of point estimates, the intervention affected boys much more than girls. So for example, here we get numbers like 45 and 51%. Of a standard deviation in cognition and language. Now, you know, you have to be, of course, careful. Not all of them are significant. Only the language one is significantly different from each other. That's something that we need to look at more carefully. Then we split up by mother's education. The question that you're asking is, are you reaching the lowest of the low or the slightly better off of the low? And the answer is, unfortunately, that at least the point estimates are much higher for the ones who have slightly better educated mothers than the ones who have lower educated mothers. Right? So that's another question to resolve. Is it that our curriculum is perhaps too hard for the kids at the lowest part of the distribution? Or are we not communicating with the mother well enough? You know, that's a question. Again, so if you look at overall, if you look at the factor index, you know, there's a suggestion that these differences are different, that these are significant between the two education groups. 8% p-value. If we look at the mechanism, this is kind of interesting now. So, what's happening in the background? This is from Colombia. These p-values, by the way, these ones are not adjusted for multiple testing. We see a very large increase in homemade toys and in bought toys. We see a large increase in play materials. We see a large increase in play activities in the branch that does stimulation. Now, if you want me to turn it from an economics point of view, I would say the parents are crowding in resources, not crowding out resources. They are doing more as a result of what I'd like to characterize as an in-kind transfer. In the micronutrient branch, where we saw no impact, we also see very little effect on all these dimensions. So the micronutrient branch, which just got iron and zinc and vitamins and nothing else, the parents are not doing more and we are not getting impacts. In the stimulation component, the parents are doing much more and we're getting impacts. Okay, so it kind of aligns perfectly. So let's go also to India. The quality of the home environment is an index of these things that we just saw. We see again that in India, the treated group has a much better quality of the home environment. Right? Again, matching up with the effect of the intervention. And by the way, look at this. We also see an effect on maternal depressive symptoms, which is, in other words, you know, an overall better and more constructive environment in the home. So we think, and I'm going to show you some evidence that this is the conduit of the intervention. The intervention, really, you should think of it as a parenting intervention, right? You know, basically, of course, the child is there, but basically what you're doing there, you're changing the behavior of the parents. Now, let's think back. You know, I'm not sure I want to waste real resources to look at that, but if I had money, I would want to test it. We are targeting the intervention. We're doing things with parents directly in a very prescriptive fashion. You could say, as an economist, well, perhaps you should just give them the money and see what happens. Well, there are many reasons, both economic and psychological, where this might not work. The economic might be that parents have other priorities in some sense, right? They want to spend their resources differently. There's an amount of altruism, so that's going to be diluted. And doing conditionalities for very, very young kids is very hard. The psychological thing is about beliefs. There's accumulating evidence, for example, by Flavio Cunha, and now by a new paper by Orazio Tanasio and Flavio Cunha and Pamela Jervis, who is also on this, show that poor parents, both in the U.S. and in Colombia, underestimate the impact of investing in kids. So basically, they work on they believe kids grow naturally. All you have to do is kind of protect them, right, from bad things that can happen. But otherwise, they just grow naturally. right? So there is an issue of beliefs. And when we are intervening there, we believe that we are shifting these beliefs. So I personally do not believe, although I do not have the hard evidence to prove it, that the cash transfer is going to have the same impact. So that's but you could raise that question intellectually at least. How much do these things cost? They cost about $170 per child per year. Right now, you might say, is this a lot? Is this not a lot? Well, okay, in some metrics it's a lot, right? Because the GDP per capita in India is $1,700. So, 10% of GDP per capita. But of course, not for the entire, you wouldn't be doing that for the entire Indian population. You'd be doing it in a very targeted way in a particular communities. By the way, 50% of the cost is monitoring and supervision, which might be subject to economies of scale. In Colombia, it's $500 per year per child. Don't forget, Colombia is, as I'm showing you here, is much wealthier than India. You wouldn't quite see it if you went to these villages, but it's $6,300 per capita in the relevant year, 2010. So another thing that we, oops, go on. That's, yeah, we're great. I obviously need to be intervened upon. I think Apple needs to be intervened upon. So I'm going to rush a little bit now, but we also carried out another intervention in Colombia where we literally partnered with the government and we used a program that they have, the FAMI program, where basically they offer services to parents. And what we went and did there, we did two things. First of all, we introduced a variant of the curriculum I talked to you about, adapted for groups. And secondly, we offered nutritional supplementation, this time not in vitamins and calories, but in actual food. Again, an economist would be horrified because they'd say all this is going to be crowded out, right? They're going to share it and so on. Which is, of course, a really important question. It might, we have to worry about that. So this intervention is smaller. It lasted only 10 months. However, it's large scale. About 90 communities, 1,500 kids. And the kids were actually, when we went in, some kids were just newborns, so the range that we intervened is between 0 and 1. And look, we actually get stuff there. And, the key problem here, of course, is attendance. So the home visits, you control attendance much more. The home visitor goes to the home. Here they have to come to the center. So we get, we get a significant 15% improvement in cognition. Height overall does not seem to be affected. But look at this. When we actually break down the height in slices of the distribution, right, and we correct for multiple testing, so we're not cheating here, we see that effectively we are reducing what's called the risk of stunting, less than one standard deviation, and we are putting kids in the middle part of the distribution. Right? And that's significant. Right? And what does that mean? Well, first of all, it means that we were addressing a nutritional issue, and it also means that the parents did not crowd out this intervention. They actually, the intervention stuck with the kids. Now, whether that would happen in the long run or not, that's again another important question. So these are the, so I basically showed you results from three experiments, right? The kind of results I showed you, just to summarize, show that these interventions that we are implementing are actually shifting, are improving child outcomes. They are changing parental behavior in favor of the child, right? And they are, in other words, they're achieving some of our goals. So now I'm going to outline quickly an approach that we have to understand the mechanism a little bit better. So we're going to kind of shift from the intervention child development kind of things to terms like human capital production function, investment, and so on. So we're going to estimate production functions for kids in the treatment group and kids in the control group in Colombia. And the aim is to try and see if we can figure out what's going on and what's mediating the intervention. So one way that the intervention can be mediated, as I already hinted, is by parents doing more with their kids. The other might be that we are changing the production function. Now, this can happen in two ways. One is that we're adding a new input. The new input is the intervention itself, if it is an input on its own. The other is that we may be somehow getting the parents to be more productive in the kind of, which is almost like saying there's some kind of unobserved input that changes between treatment and control. So to do this, we build on the approach of Cunha, Heckman, and Shenach. Cunha and Heckman, and Heckman, Pinto, and Savaliev, who basically have a body of work looking at child development and child human capital production functions and estimation methods. What we do is we assume that human capital is given by different factors, reflecting cognitive and non-cognitive skills. We need to measure investments, and we want to measure their effects. And then we all, and we believe that investments reflect household choice under possibly distorted beliefs. So we will not be estimating a fully structural model here. Why? Because we do not want to impose the restriction that parents know the child production function when they invest. Because we are going to be picking up the production function not from parents' beliefs, but from what actually we see happening. We're going to see the initial conditions of the kids. We're going to see what's going to happen at our follow-up survey. We're going to estimate the human capital of child development. But we're not going to assume that parents know it. Then we're going to estimate separately investment functions, reduced form investment functions for what we call materials and quality time. And then we're going to put the two together to try and do our mediation analysis. So we're going to model the evolution of human capital from age 1 to age 3. In itself, there's not much that's been done on that before, such an early stage. Of course, we can do it because we're collecting our own data, and that's our population. We're going to use a factor model. I'm not going to go into details. There are the papers I refer to and others that I've been writing with Emily and Horacio. And we have all sorts of technical details there, but the heart of the factor model is a measurement equation, what we call a dedicated measurement system, where each measure relates to one factor. You could generalize, but I'm not going to talk about that now. Theta is the thing we would like, the substantive thing we would like to model. M is what we observe, like all these tests of the kids that we carry out, and epsilon is a measurement error, which is supposed to be classical. Lambda is a factor loading basically translates the observed, translates the factor, maps it into the measure. So basically, we'll be estimating these four equations. I'm saying four because at the top you've got two investment equations, and at the bottom you've got two production functions. The investment equations depend on the following. They depend on whether the child was treated or not. And then they depend on the cognitive and socio-emotional initial conditions of the child. These are these two things. And they depend on the cognitive and socio-emotional development of the mother herself. And then they depend on a bunch of instruments that we'll be using to instrument investments, because we want to treat investments as endogenous. Why? Because if there are shocks to production function, the parents might compensate by investing more or perhaps investing less. And in itself, that can bias the impact. On the production function side, we're going to estimate a simple Cobb-Douglas. Again, we're going to allow, to cut a long story short, the TFP in that production function to depend on whether the child was treated or not. And then the production of human capital will depend on the initial conditions of the child when we measure them at baseline, that's before the treatment, on the capabilities of the mother, and on the investments in material and time, and on other things, like, for example, how many children there are in the household, things like that. Children are going to be, by the way, both in the investment and the production function. Why? Because in the investment function, they might dilute resources, but in the production function, they might actually improve child outcomes. For all of you worrying, you know, having three kids, did I destroy the life of my child, of my first child? It turns out it's fine. You're investing slightly less in all of them, but actually it's good for them to interact. That promotes their cognition. And I'm an only child, so I can say that without any conflict of interest. At the heart of this model is the measurement system. So I'm just going to show you the measurement for investments. I'm not going to show you everything because I think I've got 3 minutes or four. So here, for example, what does material investment mean? It means the number of types of play materials, the number of books, toys, and so on. And what's quality time? Whether you read to your child the last 3 days, a number of different types of play activities that you did with your child, and so on. These are the investments. So these things here, let's say these five things load onto one thing, which is material investment. And then the next thing, these five things load onto one thing, which is time investments. Okay, I already discussed that. So this is the investment equation. Personally, when we estimated that, I found it fascinating. What do you see? Okay, first of all, let's get the experiment out of the way. There's a very large treatment effect on both investments. Investments go up by 20%, material investment, and time investments by 30%, 33%. So yes, it's happening. Now, mothers of higher levels of cognition invest more in their kids independently of the cognition of the child. So you can see here the roots of perpetuating inequality, right? So even if you have a high ability child, basically if they're born to a low ability mother, they're going to be invested less in, right? So that's kind of the root of inequality. Number of kids, as I said, has a negative effect on investments. Right, parents invest in our subject child less if there are more children out there. And the effect is quite strong and very robust. Now, the last three red things are the instruments. So, for materials, effectively, we're using prices. Toy prices and food prices in the locality. Toy prices are reduced material investment, not a big surprise, and food is a substitute for materials. Okay, perhaps again not a huge surprise. And they are very significant. Overall p-value is about 1.3%. Now quality time is much harder to model. Why? Because the opportunity cost of time is not what's playing here. And actually the intervention did not change labor supply. We have other tables for that. So our instrument for that is whether the mother, when she was a child, was subject to conflict, witnessed civil conflict in her village through the civil war. Now, we are referring to a literature on PTSD and all that basically shows that mothers that are exposed to violence are worse at parenting. They engage less with kids. And it actually seems to be more or less randomly allocated with respect to other characteristics. So it's a pretty good instrument. Very quickly, I won't even, that's where I will show you this and then I'll conclude. What are we seeing here? We're seeing that the intervention works through investments, not through shifting the production function. The effect of treatment on cognition directly is basically small and insignificant. Material investment is what does it. And you only see that once you've instrumented it. You see, if you don't instrument material investment, you get a hugely down bias coefficient. When you do instrument it, you get a much, much larger coefficient. In some sense, this is our preferred specification here, where basically cognition is autoproductive from past cognition, and basically you've got material investments and the number of children that matter as well, as I told you, but matter in a positive fashion. So the basic conclusion is that this is basically a parenting intervention. It affects, it pushes parents to do more. By doing more, they become more effective. But very importantly, the effects can fade. This coefficient is not one, is not larger than one. So there is an autoregressive component there. So that does tell you something about sustainability of the interventions. If parents stop doing what they're doing, at least at this level that we've moved things, I can't extrapolate to 80 or 100% of a standard deviation to reach the Jamaica experiment, but for 26% of a standard deviation, this is what's telling you, that if parents stop doing this, this is going to fade. And we have evidence on that, direct evidence. Thank you.